RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Dr. David Bell is a clinical and public health physician with a PhD in population health and background in internal medicine, modelling and epidemiology of infectious disease. Previously, he was director of global health technologies at Intellectual Ventures Global Fund in the USA, program head for malaria and acute febrile disease at the Foundation for Innovative New Diagnostics, FIND, in Geneva. And he worked on infectious diseases and coordinated malaria diagnostics strategy at the World Health Organization. He's worked 20 years in biotech and international public health with over 120 research publications. He's based in Texas, USA. David is also a senior scholar at Brownstone Institute, and we've invited him back on to discuss pandemic preparedness as a path towards global fascism and the pushing of monkeypox fear as the latest example of this. David, welcome back to RCR Breakfast. Nice to have you back again.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. It's good to be back.
Okay. Where are we, David? Where are we now?
We're right where we thought we'd be, I think.
Yeah.
We everything is in place and little outbreaks become major international emergencies, and we rolled out mass vaccination to make lots of money, and that's exactly what we thought would happen. So it's where we are.
Groundhog Day.
Yeah. I think, you know, we're going to see it a lot. I think we've talked here before about how there's a whole industry now that is just, there's thousands of people whose job is just to do this, to find a variant or a new virus, a small outbreak, to make a big deal of it. The media is ready, and then to mass vaccinate millions of people. So that's what we're talking about again.
So we need to know a bit about Mpox. Don't even like saying it, actually, because it makes me cringe. Can you tell us a bit about what this is, where it's come from, and why?
No, I mean, it's a real disease, like most of these, like COVID, It's we've known about it for 25, 30 years, but it's probably been around for thousands. It's called Mpox instead of monkeypox because it monkeypox was a misnomer. Its reservoir that animals are normally resides in are rodents, squirrels and rats and so on in Africa. So it was fine to change it to Mpox. So there's an outbreak a couple of years ago, a couple of outbreaks. There's one in Nigeria that's virtually gone now. There was one in sort of international one, and we had an emergency then after five people died. And there was particularly in the homosexual community, men who have sex with men. It was related to a lot of sexual behavior, a lot of exposure. But it's transmitted by very close contact, including sexual contact. That sort of died away, about 120 deaths in the whole world. Now, since then, there's some different variants or clades in different countries in Africa. Now, the main outbreak has been in Democratic Republic of Congo. It's been going for about 1.5-2 years, slowly increasing, although it's increasing much less now, so it looks like it's leveling off. So this year it has about 500 people, it seems, have died, and we can come back to these figures because they're really unclear.
Yeah,
but there's reported, and WHO headquarters says, etc., about an African CDC, about 15,000, 16,000 cases and about 500 deaths. Most of those deaths are in children. In children, it has a mortality rate, case fatality rate of about 10%. But there's no information available on who these children are. So very likely they are very sick children.
With bad health anyway? Is that what you're saying?
With bad health anyway, monkeypox is worse than people with HIV, et cetera, and this is an area where there is a lot. So it's, but I mean, we can come back to this because it is amazing that we don't know. that it isn't being said. The Lancet editorial, that's a medical journal, a couple of days ago said it's less than 2% with adequate care, which suggests that most of these children somehow, despite an 18-month outbreak and all the money that's being spent on managing outbreaks, aren't getting adequate care.
David, what would adequate care be, just for the listeners?
Well, that's a good question. So it's probably good nutrition, supportive therapy. But basically that. So it suggests that there are some very basic measures that are not being undertaken.
Yeah.
That's not surprising. DRC is a very difficult place. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. It has a population of over 100 million. It's a huge country. Geographically, it's the size of Western Europe. It has big problems with a civil war going on. A lot of that is around the fact that our countries want very cheap batteries for our cell phones and our electric vehicles. They need cobalt and other rare metals, and DRC is one of the main sources of them. So there is a lot of child labor in the mines, etc., and they tend to be run by warlords, or there's involvement there. So it's had a lot of political problems. To put it in context, which is really important in any public health issue, those 500 deaths that are reported in that time in the same country, about 40,000 children have died of malaria. So 80 times the number have died of malaria. And that many people have probably died of TB there, tuberculosis. 500 deaths from this, that's the equivalent globally of how many die every 4 hours from tuberculosis. That's important. This is a very small outbreak in global terms. It's a small outbreak in the terms of the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's not many people getting sick compared to what else they have there. They have much, much bigger problems. This is a side issue there. But it has been made, it is the thing dominating the media. It's been declared an a public health emergency of international concern. And now we're talking about vaccinating over 10 million people for a disease that's killing very few, that it sounds like is far less will die. And almost certainly most of the children who are dying will be badly malnourished, very likely immunocompromised, perhaps due to HIV or other issues. We don't know, but we should. So that there are other issues, you can control HIV, et cetera. You can control these other problems that these children have so that they're much more resilient. Then they won't die as likely of this or of measles or of all the other viral infections that are out there. That's why we live longer in Western countries, because we have better nutrition, better living conditions. So, but on the numbers, so they're the official numbers, but there's also numbers within the African office of much, much lower mortality and much lower case numbers, and of a mortality rate of just less than 1%. So it's very unclear. There's figures that clash. The highest figures are very small compared to what else is going on in that part of the world.
We don't see a response to those horrendous numbers that you've, or do we? And certainly not at an international level. I guess it's contained to geographic areas, but no one's sort of making a big deal about that. And that's far bigger.
Yeah, well, malaria, I mean, we put $3 billion into malaria, which is about a third of what we put into COVID vaccination for Africa. Those numbers in real terms are declining. Tuberculosis funding in real terms is declining. Nutrition funding internationally has declined about 20% since 2020. These are the things which are the big health concerns there. It's what the WHO, the International Public Health Committee, would have been prioritizing 30 years ago. And this would have been a small outbreak in the background, may not have been noticed. It's due to very close contact, so you can manage it and you would expect it to go away. But the things have changed, as we know, and as we saw in COVID. Now, public health has got a very different model. We have a whole industry that is increasing at the moment since the changes to the international health regulations in May, concentrating on more surveillance so that we can find things like this, distinguish them, and then react. And the reaction is mass vaccination, as if there is nothing else we can do, rather than dealing with the underlying causes that allow people to die more frequently from infectious disease.
So issues with the numbers, the data not being clear, and the amped up selling of it, I'll use that word. It's obvious, isn't it, that this is setting up for the business model that we've talked about already.
Exactly, yeah.
That's what that means, right?
It does, unfortunately. And I mean, but yeah, I mean, what is disappointing, if you look at this from a rational point of view, you say, okay, it's not a business thing, everyone's serious about it. We've been spending billions of dollars on improving surveillance, et cetera. And yet this has been going for 18 months or more in DRC. We've still got these very unclear numbers on how many people have died. No information is coming out. There must be that somewhere, but no information is being made public to the people who paid for all this on the underlying factors that are causing people to die versus not die. You know, the immune deficiency, et cetera. So these are the basic things that normally you would do if you had an outbreak, and they've had over a year to do it. So it's disappointing that despite all the hype and all the money and all the, you know, the noise around pandemics, that we seem to be much less good at this than we were in the past.
In terms of the first mention of monkeypox, as it was called back then, not too long ago, now Mpox, it kind of feels like a rebranding exercise. Like it didn't fly the first time, so it's made some sort of comeback as a repackaged thing.
Yeah, it's not really true. The name was changed during the last outbreak, so back in 2022. So, I don't think that's unreasonable. People have been talking about the name change, but I think, it's not an unreasonable thing to do because it has nothing to do with monkeys. And it was named, it wasn't like the people in Central Africa where it's an issue named it. It was named in a laboratory in Denmark because they noticed it in the monkey, but the monkey had got it from a rodent. So it was just a mistake.
Okay, so some more questions on this, David. What do you think is likely to happen from this point on? Give us, if you can, some sort of timeline of this rolling out into the world. I'm picking that our listeners are wondering, will it again be like the COVID experience or a variation of that?
It's not going to be like COVID because they won't be able to do that because we're not going to get little outbreaks happening all over the place. So it's spread by very close contact, by sexual contact or other very close contact within a family. There's been a case in Sweden, which was someone got off the plane after close contact in DRC. Case in Pakistan, which I assume is the same, is someone off a plane. And then, there was some noise about in the US about a couple of cities that were, they found it in the sewers, but that will be the clade from 2 years ago, which is clade two, which is, it was the one that was in the homosexual community. And there's still a little bit of that around. And if you screen sewers, you find all sorts of things. It doesn't mean you've got an outbreak. So, because of the way it spreads, it's not an airborne virus. It's not going to spread very fast. It's not going to spread very far. And if you don't have very close contact, usually sexual contact with someone who's got it, then you're not going to get it. So And it's not like HIV where someone can get it and 3 months later they don't realize they've infected five people. It's something that you get after a few days, you're sick, and then you get these characteristic skin rash. So it's pretty obvious.
Yeah, I've seen some of the images of the skin rashes. That's going to freak people out. That's so visual. It looks so bad, you know?
Yeah, the virus is in the same family as cowpox and smallpox. And it looks like a very, very mild case of smallpox if you look at the old pictures of that.
Yeah, but you can see how it could drive the fear, I guess, is what I'm getting towards, the imagery.
Yes, except it's not going to be all the people down the street have got this. It's probably never going to get to most countries. And if it does, it'll be someone who got off a plane from one of the affected countries in Central Africa. And then it won't spread to more than one or two people because it'll be noticed and they just have to stay home for a few days.
How do you anticipate then this will be, okay, you've been to New Zealand, we're not too different from anywhere else. I already see in our media, they've got the graphics of these horrible looking viruses, the artist renditions, because they're too small to photograph or get an image of, I take it. So already that is back. They look even scarier, I got to say, than the COVID one. So that's starting to happen.
Well, it's funny. I mean, shingles can look really bad, can't it? That's all over the place in New Zealand. There are plenty of other diseases that give you skin rashes and bulbous skin rashes like this. It's a recognized side effect, uncommon one of the COVID mRNA vaccines. But we didn't see pictures of it in the paper then, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But we will see this. We will see a mass vaccination campaign almost certainly in Central Africa where they'll probably vaccinate over 10 million people, most of whom will probably have never been at any significant risk at all from this. In running that campaign, they will divert some tens of millions, possibly hundreds of millions of dollars, and a lot of people who normally look after things like children with malaria, keep people's TB treatment up to date. So all those people will be diverted to giving vaccinations for a vaccine made by a wealthy company, a pharma company. Yeah. And so we would expect in that case to see an increase in mortality locally from these other diseases, which will be looked after less well. So that's the unfortunate reality for the people there, because there's an industry that needs to be fed around pharmaceuticals in the West, essentially.
Do you see censoring of dissent coming again? Maybe it hasn't gone away. Enforcing health measures like, vaccine passports, border controls, those sorts of things on the back of this particular one.
I suspect some countries will bring in border controls for people from Africa, and that'll be highly inappropriate. This is in a whole year, almost 8 months, is 15,000 people in a country of 100 million, which is in an area of 1.4 billion. So it's like something breaks out in the South Island of New Zealand and you stop everyone in Indonesia from going to Europe. I mean, that's the sort of logic here. So we'll very likely see that. But I think the sort of stay-at-home orders and that sort of thing won't come because that would just be pushing it too far with this particular disease. I think that will be more likely with bird flu, which,
About bird flu. Yeah.
It's gone off. It was a big thing. It's gone off, but it'll come back. Bird flu is the one that they can do that with more effectively than this. So, I'm sure that bird flu hasn't been forgotten. There's a lot of surveillance going on. There's also gain-of-function research going on around bird flu. So it's not out of the question that we'll have a lab leak that will give us another COVID that way.
Sounds like we're in for a period of relentless sledgehammering with pandemic after pandemic after emergency after emergency. It's got that feel.
Yes.
Do you think?
That is what we're in for. And we've set up a system where that's inevitable. We can find little viruses, little variants, little outbreaks everywhere. We're spending tens of billions of dollars. The aim is to spend $30 billion a year, essentially, to do that. And that surveillance network will find this, because this is nature. You know, we've always had monkeypox. We've always had outbreaks. We just couldn't recognize them. And they're so small and insignificant that they don't matter. They don't rise up above the background. But when you've got people there trying to test every sample they can find and testing animals, testing sewers, testing sick people, trying to find these rare viruses, then sometimes you will find them and you can say, well, there's a potential for an outbreak. So therefore, right, we need to get the whole thing rolling. And that is the sort of pandemic industrial complex which we've built over the last 10 years.
So $30 billion you just mentioned, there has to be a return on that for the complex, doesn't there? And it has to be greater than the expenditure, you would think.
Yes. And the documents that the World Bank and WHO and so on use say that you'll get a 200 times return on that.
Do the sums.
Mm. Yeah. So, that's phenomenal. So this is another whole conversation, but it's completely flawed logic, and the data is not there to support it. But this is the narrative that they're pushing in order to get that money. They're talking about 70 to 200 times return. This is based on the idea that millions of people die every year from respiratory virus pandemics, whereas in reality, since the Spanish flu, we had about 1 million in late 50s, 1 million late 60s, less than normal flu with swine flu in 2009, and then COVID, which was people at an average age of about 80, perhaps about 7 million, 2 million a year for four years. So that, on that basis, essentially, we're being told 2.5 billion people or so die every year, and that if you put these measures in place, there won't be any at all. It's assuming 100% will stop. And COVID is incredibly expensive because it costs trillions of dollars to the economy, which is, as we know, because we closed down industries, we sent all the people who weren't at risk home and stopped them working, etc. So we imposed an enormous cost on a virus that affected old people. And you put that as some of the costs, and then you say, well, if we stopped it altogether, we would never have to lose that. So you know, that's a sort of window into the logic behind this, which is not it's not what the World Bank and WHO would have done 20 years ago, because it's completely flawed logic. But it is what you do, I think, if you're, you know, if you know that that's what you're being paid to do and that nothing else will be acceptable when you hand your report in. So,
and that's what's driving it, isn't it? The way this whole establishment is funded. It's at the control, I guess, of the direct funders and the corporates, I take it, on the whole, and oligarchs. And that's fascistic then, isn't it?
Well, it is. The best way to describe it, I think, is sort of fascism without borders or international fascism. I'd encourage people to, we've talked before about the reports from University of Leeds on, from the repair project, REPPARE. And there's a long report on the funding and a long report on risk. And I would encourage people to try to look them up and read them through, because they logically go through what is happening here in terms of the way evidence is misrepresented and so on. So, you know, Mpox is a real thing. SARS-CoV-2 virus was a real thing. You know, we can argue about where it came from, and the odds look stronger it came from a lab. But however it leaked out or whatever, and whatever was the gain-of-function research that was probably done on it, it was a real virus. It made people sick, you know. But these are, you know, you go back before then and you're back to 1918, last time we had a really big one. And most people died then because that was a pre-antibiotic era.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have penicillin. We didn't have sulfonamides, the basic stuff. Most people died from the flu from a secondary bacterial infection, which is one of the reasons why most of the people that died were fairly young, is that they got pneumonia and died. So that won't happen anymore. Yeah. We won't have another Spanish flu. People talk about the Spanish flu coming back, you know, every 100 years or 400 years or whatever. We probably won't ever have something like that again, because we have, one, better living conditions and nutrition, certainly in wealthier countries. And that's why all infectious disease has been going down over the last 50 years, a steady trend downwards. And secondly, we have things like antibiotics and medical care, which, you know, I think most people can recognize improve.
I understand that.
Most people can recognize it improved from 100 years ago.
Yeah, of course.
Now, we may choose not to use it, or we may choose to, you know, intubate people when we know it's dangerous for them, or withdraw medicines that we know are completely safe.
But, which is exactly what happened.
Yeah, but that's another choice. But theoretically, we could use those things sensibly, and then we would be far better off. And so we're not going to, you know, there won't be a bubonic plague, there won't be a Black Death again, because that's a bacterial infection that's simple to treat.
Yeah.
So when people hear about these, we could have another pandemic. I mean, ask why. Because we don't know any pathogens that can do it.
That's what I was going to get to next, is discerning between genuine health threats.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the sell job for the industry. It's difficult for many people to do that, to even actually come to the realization that they might have to do that.
No, absolutely. Yeah, you think you can trust, you know, the CDC, the regulatory authority, you know, TGA in Australia or the New Zealand equivalent or whatever. You assume that you can trust the Department of Health. You assume you can trust the World Health Organization. It's perfectly reasonable that people think that. So, yeah, that's why it is so difficult to get this across. And you assume you can trust the media, or at least maybe you don't, but you assume that they would not go out of their way to lie with you just to help a company get more profit. And until you look at this logically and you understand. So in the US where I live, you know, the main sponsor of public mass media is the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah,
and the food
I've seen
industry.
It. I was in there recently. I was in the States in January this year, and one night I sat down and thought, I wonder what's on the local channel. Oh my God.
Yeah, pharmaceutical.
Pharma after pharma for things I'd never even thought of that could exist.
Just so if that stops, then most of these newspapers and TV stations will stop. They depend on this. So yes, of course, they will do what they're told and they will play the game, because otherwise they don't exist. But people need to realize this. They need to realize these dependencies and how business works now, and that these pharmaceutical companies, they don't belong to a country. They don't belong to any particular jurisdiction. They can buy most of the politicians. They can just leave a country, you know, that they can tell a country, we will withdraw our 30,000 jobs and put them somewhere else unless you do what we want. So it's very difficult even for honest politicians to stand against companies of this size and industry of this size.
What would there need to be, David, in your assessment, and I think it's we need to think about this again, to have some sort of ultimate circuit breaker to stop this happening and to return, you know, the management of public health, global public health, to what it used to be, to more logical basis, which is actually effective and deals with the real problems like we talked about before with malaria, etc. Is there any possibility of that, do you think, or is this just too much money to be made?
Well, anything is possible, and we do need something. I mean, people need something. So maybe we don't New Zealand or the US so much, but, you know, the international public health community does save a lot of lives from malaria. It does save a lot of lives from tuberculosis by improving treatments, improving prevention, getting that message out there, managing, you know, supporting supply lines, supporting countries technically, that has a huge impact, and we know it has a huge impact. So those things need to continue, but they're not things you can make a lot of money out of. So they're getting the funding, they're going down, other things are going up. The other things are going up because of this conflict of interest, because we let private sector money, private sector individuals on boards of some of these organizations to direct it. And they inevitably will feather their own bed because that's their job, to improve profits. So I think the first step is we have to completely divorce the big health agencies like WHO, et cetera, Gavi, which is harder because it's half private, but I mean, it shouldn't exist unless it can be divorced. The UN itself and regulatory agencies in countries, they have to be completely divorced from any dependence on the private sector. And that will mean they have a bit less money, but it'll mean that the quality of their work is, you know, orders of magnitude better over time. And I think that is possible, but it is extremely difficult because most of the decision makers are part of this, you know, industry, part of this problem.
Yeah, revolving door.
Yeah, so it would need very strong governments, a few very strong governments, to say that, you know, we're not going to be part of this. We're not going to fund an organization that is clearly a public health negative and working for the private sector more than the public. But we will fund these other things which are clearly a public good. And you know, they will be funded on this basis. This is a constitution. WHO has one that's not working very well. You know, it needs to have things like there has to be a firewall between them and the private sector. There has to be no money from the private sector at all. They can't work closely with them. It doesn't mean they cannot work at all, but there has to be a huge barriers, and sometimes they will be awkward, but they will stop the inevitability that we're seeing now, which is, you know, it's not only destroying public health, it's going to destroy society. Every time this happens, everyone gets poorer, except for the people who are selling the stuff.
In the country where you are, latest news politically is that RFK Jr. may suspend his campaign and take a position potentially in a Trump administration to do with health. I don't think it's been very well defined, but that's what I've seen reported. And I think Trump's made a few comments about Big Pharma. Could that be some kind of, I don't know, game changer? If the administration changes and someone like RFK comes in with the history that he has behind him, I mean, his eyes are wide open, aren't they?
You said a lot of pretty sensible stuff. I would say I hope so. If you're a politician on any side, you're trying to work through a massive bureaucracy, which is the sort of thing we talk about. It's not just the international sector, is it? There's a within countries as well. There's the same problem. The FDA here has a revolving door with pharma. I mean, that's clear. There's people, they're on the FDA, next year they're in pharma, next year they're on the FDA. CDC, the same. So, in theory, it could be a really good thing. In practice, it's going to be very difficult. We would hope that they have the right advisors and the right the support generally to do it. In the end, they need a lot of public support to do it. Any politician on either side will be able to do this if the public can see the problem and support them.
Yeah.
At the moment, I think in New Zealand, certainly in Australia as well, there are some politicians who are speaking up, but they're not getting the public support. The media vilifies them and everyone just goes along with the media and turns their brain off. And I think, you know, if we can support these people, then there is a chance.
Wow. Okay. Like I say, Groundhog Day. And
yeah.
I hope it's not as predictable as I feel it might be. Always good to catch up with you, Dr. David Bell. Thanks for making some time for us again. We'll keep an eye on this one. And is it possible that monkeypox could merge with bird flu? That would be the next.
Yeah, it won't. They're completely different viruses. And I just say in finishing.
You know, I know that, but
monkeypox is a real thing. If you've lost your kid, in DRC from monkeypox.
I'm not diminishing
it. No, I realise that. But I'm just saying, it's a real thing, but it's a small problem in DRC, tiny problem in the world. And the way to deal with this is not, this massive international response, extremely expensive response. It is concentrating on where the problem is, on the people who are at risk and helping them. And they're dying because of the situation they're in. That's what we've got to fix.
Well, that's sadly ironic that it's the green agenda that's driving a lot of the
unfortunate
hardship there.
Yeah.
And the power plays going on there. But it's also, it's terrible that you're leveraging the death of kids, actually, in a poorest country in the world to kind of make your money. It's a very cynical, at least a very cynical thing, if at most a very evil thing to do, I would suggest.
Yeah. If you listen to like the Scottish COVID inquiry and the way that things were done in nursing homes, it's not just kids. It sounds like the same sort of leveraging might have been done during COVID.
Right.
So it's again, it's a pattern which is pretty galling, pretty sad.
Thank you, David.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.